It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, report cards for Wisconsin public schools are out today. We'll look at the state's best and worst schools and what the new report has to tell us.
First, the decision by a federal appeals court to reinstate Wisconsin's voter ID law has sent state officials scrambling to implement the law before the midterm elections, which are 7 weeks away.
Last Friday's ruling by the 7th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago is also leading to some confusion among voters who wonder how the law will affect their ability to vote and what forms of ID they'll need.
The law requires voters to show photo identification when casting ballots. According to a lower court judge who had overturned the law, around 300,000 or 9% of Wisconsin's voters don't have the appropriate ID.
With us now is Kevin Kennedy, director and general counsel of Wisconsin's Government Accountability Board. Kevin, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, we just use the word scrambling. Do you feel as though you at GAB and county clerks, local clerks around the state are scrambling to try to comply with this ruling?
Does that make us an omelet? I don't know. absolutely. I think everyone's been using the word scrambling. I mean, you know, on one hand, you know, we were laying the groundwork for the possibility of this happening, but until you get the court order, there's so many things that you need to step up. It's one thing to anticipate. It's another thing to put it all into place. And, you know, a lot of the questions that we answered back in 2011 and 2012 are being asked by voters now because they haven't had to worry about it.
Let's start looking at the perspective of the voter here. What do we need to know if we're going to show up to vote in person on Election Day?
Well, basically, if you show up to vote in person, you're going to be required to do three things. State your name and your address. Provide an acceptable form of identification, and sign the poll book. You've already done the first and the third thing, and for some cases, the people may have shown the ID, but there's only a limited number of ID available. We do have, or that's permissible, the most obvious one is a person's driver's license followed by a state-issued ID card. And for people who do not have either one of those now, and they can go to the Department of Transportation at the motor vehicles offices around the state and request a free ID for voting. There'll be some steps they have to follow, and they're best to look at the DMV website for that. But other forms that are acceptable for ID, primarily for, U.S. passports, tribal IDs, military IDs. And then there's a combination of documents that students have that I probably best not go into it here, but we have information on that on the website.
But a student ID card with a picture on it alone is not enough, is that right?
That's right. It's not enough. There's a combination of things they have to show on that, and it's something we spent quite a bit of time working through in the last session. Some of the universities were starting to design ID cards that would meet the statutory requirements, but most had not done that.
A U.S. district judge who had previously overturned the voter ID law, it's now reinstated, of course, in the ruling said an estimated 300,000, about 9% of Wisconsin voters, could lack a qualifying ID, the ones you were just outlining there. Will the state be able to get the message out to those voters of what they need, how they get it in time for Election Day?
I think that's one of the challenges that we face in the Department of Transportation's Division of Motor Vehicles faces. Obviously, the information is on the website, but not everyone has access to the web. And, you know, we had put together a pretty intensive public media campaign and had budgeted for it and, you know, had made arrangements, but right now that's not in the cards. We're hoping we might get some money for it, but we don't even know what type of media would be available given the fact that, last time we had lined it up a year in advance, timing it for the various elections in 2012. So really, we're going to be taking advantage of as much free media as we can and doing our best to increase the visibility of this issue. But to a large extent, recognizing that press coverage may help energize the voters.
We've been talking about voting in person. Now, how about the absentee ballot? Obviously, if you're filling out a ballot at home and mailing it in, you're not showing someone your physical ID card. How do you present ID in that case?
Well, to request an absentee ballot, you have to send, along with your written request, or if you happen to be in the clerk's office, present. But let's say you're not in the clerk's office. If you want the ballot mailed to you, usually you send in a written request, and that requires you to send a copy of an acceptable form of ID before the ballot will be mailed to you. Now, one of the challenges we have is we have at least 12,000 ballots that have already been mailed out and several hundred that have probably come back and voted already. So our municipal clerks are going to have to reach out to all of those voters and tell them in order for their ballot to be counted, they need to send in a copy of their ID. And we've directed them to do that in writing, so it's a written communication, and to do follow-up until, you know, to make sure that the people got the request. Now, all of these people have an address because we sent them an absentee ballot. So we do have contact information for them. And in the follow-up, if the clerk happens to have an email address or a telephone number, they can do the follow-up that way. But this is where I think we see that local election officials are being directed to take extraordinary steps to make sure that those people who already requested an absentee ballot or who already returned their voted absentee ballot know what they have to do. And for those people who've made the request but the ballot hasn't gone out, the clerk's going to have to do the same kind of outreach and say, I can't send you this ballot until you provide me with a copy of the ID.
Oh, and how about an out-of-state ID? Does it have to be a Wisconsin driver's license or other ID?
It has to be a Wisconsin driver's license or a Wisconsin-issued ID card, a passport, a tribal ID, or a military ID. And the important thing there is the person's name and picture.
Now, to turn it around, we've been focusing on the voter side of things. Now, to kind of your side of things, what needs to happen to make sure polling precincts are ready to handle voter ID?
Well, you know, we spent a large amount of 2011 and into 2012 developing training materials for poll workers, for municipal clerks, and informational materials for the public. And that didn't go away, and the ruling really doesn't change anything. You know, the basic requirements are still the same. There's very little that has to be changed in our training materials other than references to 2010 and 2012 that might have been there. And so we're reviewing all of that and getting information posted to the website, and we will be using our staff to talk to as many public groups as we can. There's a lot of groups that have a stake in this, League of Women Voters, the two political parties, various other social action groups who will, you know, take our materials and use them to reach out to the public. That was part of our strategy back in 2011 and 2012, was to make sure we had informational packets that, you know, community groups could say, we want to do something on photo ID. We understand you can't be here, but, you know, we have your materials. We can share them.
Are we going to need more workers at the polling stations to deal with this extra step?
That is probably going to be the case. I know Madison definitely anticipates that they'll need this. In practice, the main issue is that taking the time for a poll worker, when the ID is presented, the poll worker has four things they have to do. They have to make sure first that the ID is an acceptable form. In other words, you can't just flash a picture. It can't be an employee, you know, an employer's ID card, or as you said, an out-of-state ID. So they first have to make the judgment, this is on my list of acceptable forms of ID, that the item is current and current. Interestingly enough, if it was valid as of November 2012, the November 2012 election, that will be considered current for purposes of whether or not it's valid. And then does the picture reasonably resemble the person presenting it? It doesn't have to be an exact match, but, you know, we know people grow beards, lose weight, cut their hair, gain weight. Your looks can alter over a period of time. Our driver's licenses are 8 years old. I'm better looking than my picture.
Me too.
And the other thing is that they have to check to make sure the name reasonably resembles the name on the poll list. So, you know, minor disparities. The driver's license says Thomas, but the voter registration form says Tom. Katie instead of Catherine. Those, you know, it has to conform. The fact that the initial middle initial is missing on one but exists on the other, those aren't reasons to deprive someone of the right to vote.
Kevin Kennedy of the Government Accountability Board is with us. We're talking about how the newly reinstated voter ID law will affect voters in the upcoming election, and we want to hear it from you. Are you confused about what this law means for you on Election Day? What are your concerns about how this law gets put into place? Will it affect, do you think, your ability to vote in November? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation after we look at the latest news with Kristen Durst. This is Central Time. Rob Ferret here with Veronica Rickert. We're talking about how the newly reinstated voter ID law will affect voters in the upcoming election. You can join the conversation. Do you have a question for Government Accountability Board Director Kevin Kennedy about how this is all going to work? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also tweet at Central Time WPR. Kevin, before we go to the callers, Congresswoman Gwen Moore this morning sent you a letter saying, hey, wait until after this November election. There's not enough time. This could cause harm and confusion. Is that an option for you?
Well, it isn't anymore. I think at the time that the court order was issued, the court order basically said if Wisconsin chooses to do this, and, you know, basically our attorneys, the Department of Justice and the governor's office, had been talking with us, talking with the Department of Transportation and with Health Services, saying that if the injunction is lifted, we want to go forward with this. This is our law. It was passed in 2011. And so in that sense, the decision was made. Yes, they do want to pursue this. Obviously, people could make the case that 7 weeks is a pretty short time, which is what we're out. We're 49 days out from the election to do this. But, you know, people have adapted to election law changes or other matters, and that was the decision that the state essentially made, is we are going to go forward.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Matthew on the line in Madison. Matthew, hi.
Hi, I just wanted to just share the experience I had last year, anticipating needing to have a voter ID. And actually, I think the poll workers basically thought that I needed voter ID. So basically, I used to go to school in Milwaukee, and I moved to Madison. And I'd never had problems voting before, but I went to do the same-day registration. I brought my ID, which had my Milwaukee address, but I brought two pieces of mail. I had my new address on it, but they wouldn't take it because they said it had to be a billing, something like a bill or a light bill. But I do all of my stuff online. I didn't do any of my stuff, you know, sent to my home anymore. So they told me I couldn't do it.
Matthew, gotcha. So this is a little different issue. It's not the ID there. It's proof of residence. So if we want to show up and register same day at the poll, Kevin, what do we need to show?
Basically, you have to have a current document that meets the criteria. There's 13 different pieces of acceptable proof of residence. Obviously, a current driver's license that shows your current address and your full name. You know, the two criteria for any of these documents are that it has a current address, that it has your full name on it. And the third criteria is that it has to be current. So his driver's license is going to help. Mail that's sent to you does not fall into that category. People who have billing statements, they can print those out. We do allow electronic proof of residence. In other words, you could take your smartphone and show it to the poll worker saying, here's my utility bill. And again, that has to be a current one. You can't show it from a year ago. It has to be current within 60 days. Actually, it's 90 days of the election. So there are ways to deal with this if you are doing most of your billing online. I mean, many of us have gone paperless in this area.
And if you're not allowed to vote at the polls, I know in other states over the years I've heard of things like provisional ballots where you can cast it and provide the proof later. Do we have anything like that in Wisconsin?
We do have that that situation, and that kicks in with voter ID. There's some limited situations where you could get a provisional ballot outside of ID. The person who registered to vote by mail who never voted in Wisconsin before is required to show the same type of proof of residence. If they don't have it when they show up at the polls, even though their name is on the poll list, they would get a provisional ballot, and they would have to come back with a proof of residence before 4 o'clock on the day after, on the Friday after the election. Also, someone who walked in on election day to register to vote and said, I have a driver's license, but I don't know the number, would be given a provisional ballot, and it wouldn't count until they provided their driver's license number, because Wisconsin requires all new registrants to list their driver's license number. And now with photo ID back in place, if you show up at the polls and you do not have acceptable identification, you will get a ballot, and you have until the 4 p.m. on the Friday following the election to take that identification to your municipal clerk's office, show that. The clerk will then process your absentee ballot and count it.
Go back to our callers now. We've got Steve on the line in Stoughton. Steve, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. I was wondering if there's any research that has identified where large concentrations of folks without voter IDs are located, and if there will be an effort to go try to maybe mobile voter ID folks in those areas.
Steve, thanks. Kevin, you mentioned limited outreach potential between now and Election Day. Anything like that in the works?
You know, this is where we work with community groups. There will not be, you know, the Department of Transportation is not going to be going out, as far as I know, to these areas to assist with people getting the type of identification that's needed. Obviously, there's been research that suggests that low-income people, elderly people, students, and racial minorities tend to have less access to acceptable forms of ID. So those are the types of, and we look to talk to the community groups that interact with that. Obviously, we spend a lot of time talking to the university people and the college people here to make sure that the information on how to get an ID or what's required or what the alternatives are is as accessible as possible. One of the benefits, at least with the student population, is they're much more tech-savvy and are likely to be able to access that information fairly quickly.
Steve, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Gina with us in Madison. Gina, hi.
Hi, Kevin. My father's in a nursing home, and his driver's license expired about 4 years ago, and he's not mobile. How does he vote?
There are some exceptions for people who are indefinitely confined and for people who are in extended care facilities. Basically, someone in an extended care facility, we have some provisions where the person who operates that facility is essentially going to be vouching for the identification of the patient. And what I would do is direct you to our website to check that information out. That's an area, you know, it's a good example of areas where we'll be doing some specific outreach, talking to people who run these residential care facilities to make sure they understand the situation.
Thanks a lot for the call, Gina, and good luck to your dad on voting day. We had a caller who says she feels worried for the poll workers. Any advice for voters on the care and treatment of the people working polls on Election Day, Kevin?
Bring cookies. actually, become a poll worker would be nice. If you've got the time to volunteer, and in Wisconsin, we do allow people to work part-time, although that's a municipal decision. But I know Madison and Milwaukee, for example, you don't have to work the full 13-hour day, and they will take advantage of that opportunity. So I would encourage people to do that. It connects you to the process. You'll see some of your neighbors. But I think understanding that, yes, this is going to be a big demand on poll workers, be patient. There might be a voter in front of you who either has strong opinions one way or the other that you sort of have to hold yourself back from getting drawn into that discussion, or recognizing that some people are struggling, you know, with access to their document while they're in front of you. So I always tell people to be prepared, bring your ID, but be patient, because You know, we, most of our votes are cast in person. At this election, you know, probably 80 to 85% of the people will vote at the polls on election day.
And briefly, is there an online one-stop shop for people to get their questions answered for voter ID and other voting issues?
Well, the main place to go right now is to our website, which is GAB, for Government Accountability Board, .wi.gov. We haven't put up yet, but we have a special microsite that this is the areas where we're verifying that we don't have any typos or misdates that will, you know, there'll be a special link just to that. But there's, I have up right now, you know, if you go to our website, the very first thing you see is voter ID, more information.
All right.
And I just pulled that up.
Kevin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Happy to do it. Thank you for inviting me.
That's Kevin Kennedy, Director of Wisconsin's Government Accountability Board.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, renewable energy is usually a cause taken up by progressives and environmentalists. But the president of the Wisconsin Solar Energy Industries Association is actually a conservative. We'll hear his pitch to the GOP for greener energy in the state.
First, news about how Wisconsin's public schools are doing. The Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction released the state's report card for the 2013-2014 academic year today.
In the report, 88% of schools and 98% of districts either met or exceeded expectations. Only one school district got the ranking of failed to meet expectations, Milwaukee Public Schools. Here with us now to talk about the report, we have Milwaukee Journal Sentinel education reporter Aaron Richards. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So, big picture, does this report show an improvement or a decline compared with the previous years?
You know, they've had these report cards now for about 3 years for schools and 2 years for districts. And overall, we're seeing about what we saw in the last couple of years, and that is that almost everybody is doing pretty good. Milwaukee has some big challenges. Most of those stem from poverty. And for the most part, we're getting to see some other measures to help us see some things in schools we didn't know as well before, such as some growth scores, seeing how schools can move kids along when those kids stay with that school over a period of time. But for the most part, it's still a bit limited because we mostly know that higher income schools do better than lower income schools.
So before we dig into where there are problems and highlights, what criteria does this annual report card use to measure the schools?
Well, it's good to know what we had before, which was a system that looked at schools under the looked at their annual progress under the No Child Left Behind law. That was a federal law, and it only looked at how well schools did each year in having kids be proficient in reading and math. That's a pretty limited picture. What the report cards do is that they open the door to looking at some wider measures. So they're looking at student achievement, but they're also looking at how well schools close achievement gaps. And how well they're preparing kids for post-secondary readiness. So for high schools, you know, they're trying to incorporate measures like ACT scores. You know, down the road, we'll put more of these in there. And then you're also looking at things like attendance. Are kids actually coming to school to learn?
So it's a more nuanced view than the old system, it sounds like. Or that's the goal, anyway.
It is, and for parents in the community, these are one-page snapshots for the schools. They have a rating. Each school is rated on a five-point scale or a five-rating scale from significantly exceeds expectations to fails to meet expectations. Every school and district, for the most part, gets a score from 0 to 100. And so they're easier for people to look at, but also because there's more measures available, it can also kind of make your head spin if you're not sure what you're looking at.
And is this something that, in terms of accountability, if a school is in the failing zone, is there an idea of punitive measures, cuts in funding, as there was talk of some years back?
Well, the state has tried to get away from that a little bit. Of course, schools have to be held to some kind of standard because we want schools to continue to perform and do good things for kids. What I think makes people nervous is when you say, okay, well, if you're failing, we're going to cut off all your funding. for the most part, we still know that schools that struggle the most are often, not always, but often in really high poverty communities that are unstable and that have a lot of challenges. So essentially cutting off the funding stream to a school that's already high poverty may not be the best solution. What the state is trying to do is some more nuanced programs. So, for example, the state is trying to recognize schools that show high growth instead of just giving awards out every year to schools that are high achieving. We know districts like Whitefish Bay and Mequon Thiensville are going to be districts that are higher achieving every year. The state is also trying a program that pairs up principals from schools that struggle and higher achieving schools, or schools that are performing well in a certain area, and trying to have those principals mentor each other and talk about things like leadership development. So it's more of a nuanced way of getting at improvement rather than sort of hitting everybody with a big stick if they don't make the grade on these report cards.
Well, there's been talk about Milwaukee Public Schools for a lot of years, and in this case it's the one district that failed to meet the expectations. What were some of the main problem areas that made the district fall short in this particular report card?
Well, certainly just overall achievement is a perennial problem. That would be achievement from the state tests every year in reading and math. The district also acknowledged that a big area that it lost points in is absenteeism, meaning student absenteeism, students not coming to school. On these report cards, you have to meet a minimum level of requirements in some areas to get all of the points that add up to that 100, you know, the points that add up on the 100-point scale. So, for example, you have to have at least 95% of your kids take the state test, because you could conceivably get a higher score if you only tried to have your higher-achieving students take the test. So test participation is one. So is student absenteeism. So the district said, hey, you know, we recognize we have an issue here. We would have scored better overall if we could, you know, do something about our student absenteeism issue. So that's something I think they're taking a look at as well.
And moving to the rest of the state, while a lot of districts, most districts met or exceeded expectations, there has been a lot of concern about achievement gaps. You mentioned that earlier. Do we have a sense yet of how Wisconsin schools in general did when it came to that category, achievement gaps between whites and African Americans in particular?
We haven't broken down all of that new data yet. All of the numbers just came out today, so myself and a lot of other people are still digging into a lot of this stuff. Even from last year's report cards, there has been a renewed, or at least a kind of a greater interest in this area. There's been a task force meeting since last year about this achievement gap, and it's often one that you don't see it as prominently in suburban schools where the predominant student population is white. So those, you know, the scores of white middle-income students automatically overshadow the scores of lower-income or students of racial minorities. And so there are a lot of people looking at that achievement gap right now, and there should be some more data coming out soon about that gap over time, and I suspect you'll start to hear people talk about it this week. I know the state superintendent, Tony Evers, is even coming over to the newsroom this week to talk about that very issue.
And that Superintendent Evers also posted a YouTube message about this report, and he put a little qualifier on it. He said this doesn't include things like art, music, technology. So while there's been this move to a more careful approach to rating schools, he says, hey, there's still stuff that doesn't show up here.
That's right. These report cards still don't reflect everything that I think a lot of people would find important in a school. There are even some schools in the report cards that have failing scores. Even in Milwaukee that I've been to, they're good schools. Kids are graduating. They're going to college. They're getting scholarships. And because of some of the way the measurements work out, it just doesn't make them look as good on paper, even though they might be doing pretty good things for most of their student population in real life. But Evers really told everyone, you know, hey, these are not meant to be used as a punishment tool. We're trying to separate schools so we can see who's doing well in what areas. So it gives us more measures to look at. And frankly, you know, if you want to know more about your school, go inside the door, take a look at what they have to offer beyond just what's showing up on this one-page report.
Yeah, this has been going on for years, maybe decades, trying to find a way to objectively measure school performance. And it seems like we're still working on that, even with this qualifier from the superintendent of education on his own report card. When you talk to people at schools, do you get the feeling that they say, oh, great, report card, uh-huh, and then get back to the real work? Or is this something that they really use as part of their toolkit to figure out what they're doing?
I think that response would be determined by who you're talking to. I suspect that a lot of teachers might glance at this and say, okay, well, I get it, but, you know, I'm really focused on what I'm doing in my classroom every day. In the upper levels of administration, I certainly think there's more pressure on where your school falls every year and what this report card looks like. I think that the question is still out there about whether this is helping schools improve. You know, what's my question today to the State Department of Public Instruction was, what practical effect has this actually had on schools? After 3 years of doing this, can we show that this is helping anybody improve? And I think the jury's still out a little bit on that. I think leaders are still trying to figure out, okay, what do I do now that I know this? It probably tells me some information I already knew about my school, but what do I do with it now? And how do I get other tools or extra help or assistance in some way to improve if that's what, you know, I need to do to get my score up?
And in addition to this report card, are we still using other measures? Do we still see other evaluations either within districts or statewide?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think part of the concern among teachers anyway is that we're in such an era of big data that it's largely what they're focusing on these days. You'll hear a lot of teachers say that they wish that there wasn't quite so much testing and focus on the data, because it's actually taken away from some of the time they had in classrooms to simply instruct and, you know, and let kids be creative. There's a new test out and new scores out for even really young kids. It's a literacy screener that is given to kindergarten children to determine where they're at in terms of their sort of, you know, letter awareness and pre-reading skills. There are new tests that most schools administer 3 times a year now to see how students progress over the course of the year. And then there's the actual state achievement tests, and those are going to be administered online for the first time this year, which is a whole new learning curve for everyone. So there's certainly just enormous amounts of data out there that we're collecting and then trying to synthesize in this effort to try to improve schools.
Well, thanks for helping make sense of this, Erin.
Thank you.
That's Erin Richards. She's education reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about the new Wisconsin Public School report cards out today for the 2013-14 academic year.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Installation of solar power systems in Wisconsin has dropped since 2010. Before that, according to Midwest Energy News, the industry was growing modestly for almost a decade. Today, solar accounts for 0.1% of the state's renewable energy, barely a blip.
And with utility companies looking to raise monthly fixed rates and lower the rates at which they buy back excess solar power, advocates for renewable energy say the industry is in jeopardy.
Renewable energy growth is often seen as part of the Democratic platform, with many Republicans outright against or at least not on board. There's, for example, no mention of renewable energy in the state Republican platform out this year.
There's one very notable exception, however. Here in Wisconsin, the president of the Wisconsin Solar Energy Industries Association and co-owner of Sunvest Solar, the largest solar installer in the state, is himself a conservative. Matt Newman is the son of Mark Newman, a Republican who advocated for renewable energy and lost Republican primaries for governor and Senate in the state. Matt joins us now to talk about the solar use in Wisconsin. Matt, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon, and thank you for hosting.
Oh, what is the conservative case for expanding renewable energy like solar in Wisconsin?
Well, I think there's a whole bunch of reasons why conservatives should be in favor of solar, but I think the top few that are most relevant are the concepts of free market capitalism, property owner rights. It's really a national security issue if you get right down to an energy portfolio that has a broad-based method of producing energy. And then also, ultimately, economic development and job creation here in the state of Wisconsin. So I think there's a number of reasons. I could go down a list of a few more, but realistically, those are the core issues that I believe conservatives should be in favor of solar because of those principles that align directly with conservative philosophy.
Well, the GOP in general has dragged its feet a bit on renewable energy. As we mentioned, the party's platform adopted this year doesn't mention clean energy at all. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think there were a lot of negatives surrounding renewables in the past, and I think that has changed substantially in the last few years here. Just to give you an example, since 2010, in our own company, our cost of installations for solar systems has dropped by 65%. Meanwhile, you have utility costs going up in Wisconsin at 2.5 times the rate of inflation. So while you have utility costs increasing on everyone who has no choice but to buy their energy from the utility company, you have industries like ours that are developing primarily outside of Wisconsin and dropping our costs substantially to a point where we are now economically viable. This is no longer a discussion about needing subsidies for an industry to survive. This is about an industry that can stand on its own and compete head-to-head with utility rates.
Is there anything inherently at odds between renewable energy and the conservative platform?
There really shouldn't be. I think in the past what it was is subsidies. I think Republicans said we don't have the money, and I agree with them. We didn't have the money, nor do we have the money to subsidize industry, and I don't think that the government is in a position to pick winners and losers. However, if we're going to truly eliminate subsidies, we have to eliminate subsidies from the fossil fuel generating sources as well so that we truly know what our cost of energy really is.
The case has been made by people who are a little less enthusiastic about renewable energy that it could hurt consumers who don't have it. What do you say to that?
Yeah, are you referring to the fairness argument that's being circulated right now? Yeah, you know, honestly, there's not facts to substantiate that point of view, and that's the challenge I have with it. We're hearing a lot from the utilities right now that this is all about economic fairness, and it's about the idea that solar is being subsidized by the other ratepayers that don't have solar. Now, the fact of the matter is solar is about 0.02% of our energy mix in the state of Wisconsin. So to somehow say that that's being subsidized by other ratepayers and actually impacting the rates at 0.02% of our energy mix is just plain not true. But in addition to that, if you look at other states that have actually gone about doing a factual study on whether or not solar helps other ratepayers or hurts other ratepayers, I think you'd find, as other states did, that in fact, because solar generates a lot of its energy, about 70% of it, on peak periods, there's other cost avoidance issues as well that utilities get to benefit from. The value of solar is actually higher than the retail rate that we're getting compensated for with the net metering policy. So I think if we actually go through the factual information, our state's going to find that, in fact, solar helps reduce the cost and future burden on the electric grid that we know it today.
As president of the Wisconsin Solar Energy Industries Association, do you think that you can help move the needle on Republican support for green energy?
You know, I hope so. I hope at the end of the day the discussion is about whether or not it's an economically viable technology, because I already know the answer to that question. And I hope it's not a discussion about how we protect the bottom line of our utility companies. You know, at the end of the day what this rate case is about, and this isn't necessarily wrong for the utilities to be doing this, but the utilities are protecting their shareholders. That's really what they're doing. And I don't blame them for doing that. It's just that they probably believe that's where their fiduciary obligation is to their shareholders, and as such, they're making sure that they have enough fixed fees being generated to cover their costs of the energy transmission. At the end of the day, we want fairness too, and all we want is a fair platform to compete on, and we want the ability, things like third-party ownership in the state of Wisconsin, which the utilities are also trying to regulate through their rate case, ironically. You know, those are types of things, financing mechanisms that allow renewables to be more affordable to everyone so that no one can say we can't pay for it. If you allow third-party ownership in Wisconsin, then people do have the ability to pay for it.
And by third-party ownership, you mean that people could buy their energy from someone who's producing it en masse, like your company?
Precisely, yeah. We could install a system on your roof, as an example, and you just buy the energy as we produce it, as opposed to you having to outlay maybe $20,000 or $30,000 to put it on your roof at the beginning. So there's companies all throughout the country, ours included, that are financing these systems for homeowners, for businesses, churches, schools, et cetera. They may not have the tax credit appetite. They may not have the ability to finance something over a 20-year time period, but companies like ours do that sort of work, and we're responsible then for the operations and maintenance of the equipment as well. So it's really beneficial for people, and oftentimes there's zero upfront cost to do that.
Do you think that the Republican Party has to somehow acknowledge climate change to bring about a change in perspective about renewable energy?
You know, I don't necessarily. And interestingly enough, I got asked this question. I don't remember the publication recently that asked me that question. And they said, aren't you just dodging the question when you say, no, you're not really sure about climate change? And the truth of the matter is, I really don't know. I have not studied climate change as an issue specifically to know whether or not that's an issue. But I don't believe that Republicans have to take a position on that, because ultimately, if we support clean energy development, we are directly helping the climate change discussion. So if it is for real, and I don't mean to be hedging on it, it's just I don't personally know. I have not studied it. I'm choosing to spend my time building our renewable energy company, which would be a part of the solution to climate change were it an issue. So I don't believe Republicans have to come out necessarily and support one side or the other of the climate change issue. I think it's more important that we support clean energy development for national security purposes and the fact that we support free market capitalism and competition in the marketplace.
With the two so bundled together, though, is that a reasonable position to take? Climate change and clean energy?
You know, I believe it is, because at the end of the day, the reason that we are in favor of and the reason our company is working so hard to promote clean energy is because I believe that we need a more broad energy mix. I believe it needs to be more distributed so that we don't have specific locations that we're completely reliant upon that, given some sort of a, God forbid, a terrorist attack or something else, that could shut down our energy grid and literally shut down our marketplace. So I believe a distributed energy grid and an energy portfolio, and one that is locally generated, is something that we ought to be working towards as Republicans, Democrats, and frankly as Americans, irregardless of the climate change conversation. And so it's not, again, it's not that I'm avoiding that topic. It's just that that's not my primary driving reason, and I don't think there should be any Republicans' driving reason for supporting renewable energy. And I don't necessarily think that might be a reason why Democrats support it, but I don't think that that should be the driving reason either. I think there's way more important issues here to be discussing.
Great. Well, Matt, thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Thank you for your time.
We've been speaking with Matt Newman, president of the Wisconsin Solar Energy Industries Association and the co-owner of Sunvest Solar in Pewaukee, about the conservative case for renewable energy in Wisconsin.